Before we get into this week's episode of Small Doses Podcast, want to, first of all, thank everybody who has been showing me so much love and support as I've been like publicly bullied for the past 10 days for, you know, just being myself. But nonetheless, you guys have always made it possible to get through the just darkness of the uncertainty and unwieldiness of these internets. But that being said, it's always a time for reflection, and you guys always make it possible for there to be a safe space to do that. So I wanted to first extend that. Also want to remind you all that my tour dates are back in business. We're back in full effect, and I will be in Fort Worth in just a few weeks. Yes, Dallas, Fort Worth, Texas. You can catch me at Big Laugh Comedy Club. It's going down April 12th, 13th, and 14th. We got four stand-up shows and an Amanda We Trust political forum. So hopefully we'll see you all possibly at both. Could be. I don't know. Also, just announced dates in Detroit in June. We got dates in Baltimore and Boston. We got dates in Raleigh coming up. And I will be announcing a Los Angeles show any day now, possibly. We're still in the mix of that. And looks like I will be coming to Toronto and Philadelphia. So you got to go to AmandaSeals.com and sign up for the newsletter so that you make sure you don't miss out when we are announcing these dates. Also, want to remind you that you can now get bonus episodes of Small Doses Podcast by being a member of Patreon. All you got to do is subscribe to Patreon, and we record the episodes every Sunday. You get to be live with the recording in the chat. So it's a very unique experience for all of our folks that are not just Small Doses lovers, but are also parts of the SEALS squad. So I want to remind you all of all those dope things that we've got going on. And if you want to see the visuals with Small Doses Podcast, because the audio just ain't enough, you can also get that by being a member of the Baldwin tier at my Patreon. That is theamandaverse.com, or you can go to Patreon, just type in my name. One more thing, if you haven't listened to my other podcast, The Amanda Seals Show, which is a Radio 1 radio show and podcast, you can check that out wherever you get your podcasts. Your girl is busy continuously trying to create spaces that are expanding our love, our knowledge, and our curiosity of how to be better people and a stronger community. And I love you all for allowing me to do that and supporting me in that process. All right, let's get into this episode.
Self-help from the hip.
Small doses.
We're talking that shit.
Small doses.
And keeping it real.
Small doses.
With me and Amanda Seals.
It's so funky. Y'all, it's time for Small Doses. It's your girl. We here. And the space that we have created here at Small Doses Podcast continues to expand to just include intellectuals of such various means and methods, right? Like, I really feel honored that folks be wanting to come on this show because they're like, it's going to be worth their time. And Cole Arthur Riley is an author who she came to my consciousness because of her Instagram page, Black Liturgies. And Black Liturgies has basically just been a collection of quotes that she'll post that sometimes have like a theme, but sometimes they'll just be like, take that, take that, take that. Like, you just need to hear this today. And, you know, it's one of those things, I think it may have been on a For You page or like someone sent it to me. And then, you know, you start, then when you go to the page, you see how many of your people are following this page, because it's just curated to constantly give you this content that is grounded in Black voices and the Black experience. And I knew that she had this project, Black Liturgies, coming. She wrote another book, This Here Flesh, in the last few years. And so this project, I knew was coming, but I didn't know when. And then when it dropped, it was like, oh my God. And I hit her up on DM and said, you know, would you be down to do the podcast? And she said, yes, absolutely. And she sent me a copy of the book. And I didn't really know what to expect when I got the book, because I had only considered Black Liturgies based on how it shows up on the Instagram. But the book itself is actually very whimsical in its layout, maybe not necessarily in its content, because it does have a lot of weight to it, and it's a bit dense in terms of just like the text, and it's more to me a reference than something you would read straight through. It's kind of just like, you know, an open the book and see where it takes you kind of scenario. Like, okay, so I'll open the book and see where it takes me right now, right? So like on this page, it has contemplation, And then she has some questions that you ask yourself. Are you more prone to trust or distrust of authority figures? When did this start for you? Do you tend to assume the role of leader or follower? Does either role carry a negative connotation for you? Is this fair? Now, I love things like that because I think one of the biggest disservices that this particularly American nation has done to its people is to really make a concerted, successful effort at suppressing curiosity, at really depressing the quest for understanding and leaving that to these other people, right? Like, oh, they're going to figure out, we just got to keep going. To the point where I've had two therapists in my lifetime say to me, like, oh, we just need to get you out of your head and you just need to trust me to guide us. I don't like it. I don't like that. It's not that I don't trust them, but it's that I want you to help me understand my head. Like, I understand that sometimes we need to disconnect for the sake of restfulness, of revitalization, and of peace, but like, I don't know you. You know what I'm saying? Like, I feel like anything that we're doing where we're asking someone like to submit is, unless we're dancing to bachata, I just feel like it's not in my best interest. You know what I'm saying? It's not in my best interest. But if I hear a bum, mi amor, te quiero mucho, baby. Like, then yes, I'm going to have to submit because someone's going to have to lead in this situation. I understand that. Let's open the book and see to another page. Okay. So like, she'll have sections like Kwanzaa, morality, memory, justice. This book reminds me of Small Doses, but like from a less irreverent point of view. Like, it's more reverent. It's much more grounded in language of formality and like spirituality. Like, she has a section called dignity. And she'll start sections with quotes from various folks that are reminiscent to the Black Liturgies page. And like on this page, she has a quote from Nikki Giovanni. I am so perfect, so divine, so ethereal, so surreal. I cannot be comprehended except by my permission. And those who know the work of Nikki Giovanni know that that is from the poem Ego Trippin'. Let me tell y'all, I be knowing shit, okay? Like, sometimes I be like, Amanda, you be here for a while. You be knowing. That's why I have a whole special called I Be Knowing, yep, that y'all can watch on Max, formerly HBO. So we are going to have this conversation with Cole that really was so beautiful because she was so open and really let the conversation flow and become more than just an interview. And I think that's the best version of this podcast. So before we get into that, we're going to get into a gem drop-in and break down these two things that only came to light because of this podcast. Gem drop-in. Gem drop-in. Gem drop-in. So within this conversation, Cole Arthur Riley speaks about how the interior self has to be explored and the ways in which her exploration of her interior self were necessary for this book, the ways in which fiction works have allowed for not just her own exploration of her interior self, but of Black people's, et cetera. And I was sitting there listening and I was like, damn, I ain't never thought of it as interior self. I've always heard that contextualized as the language of the inner self, right? And some of y'all might be like, Amanda, big difference. But that's what the reason that we do gem drop-in is for. We're identifying the nuances, the intricacies between language that give us even more opportunity to use language to express ourselves. When I hear inner self, I gotta tell you, I simply just think of the mind. Like, I think of like the ways in which my mind thinks about things, the ways in which my mind processes emotions, the ways in which I kind of live in this world within my emotional and mental self. But when she said interior self, it made me reconsider that concept in a much more broader, tangible way, beyond simply like the brain, but thinking of my body and myself as the space my soul is inhabiting. And I know that that may sound esoteric, but it feels to me more like contemplative in its comprehension. Like, it feels like there's so many more like corners and crevices to look into in that than just like the inner self thought process, because it feels like I am looking at myself as a home versus just as like a computer functioning, which can feel a little like disconnected almost, right? Like when you think of yourself as a computer functioning, which I absolutely do, it feels a bit more mechanic. It feels a bit more logic driven, you know, like there's code. And if I can just master this code, then I won't get upset. I won't get sad, exterior self. Whereas the interior self feels like the place I am coming into to get out from the cold. It feels like the place that I'm coming into to celebrate my wins. It feels like the place I'm coming into to connect in solitude. And that has like so much more of a warmer welcome than the inner self. And the reason I'm bringing these nuances up is because I think, and I talk about this in the interview, I really feel like so much of our work as a community is reliant on our work in ourselves. And when we talk about the quest for the inner self, that language scares people because inner self can feel like a black hole. Like inner self feels like inner sanctum. And when people hear that, they oftentimes balk. There's a certain level of like, ooh, I ain't trying to do that because I don't know if I'll ever come back. Whereas the concept of interior self feels like walking into a familiar place that you're getting to know better. And her book, Black Liturgies, she said was an exploration of doing that for herself and for y'all. So let's get into it. All right, folks, we're here with best-selling author, Cole Arthur Riley. Hello, welcome to Small Doses Podcast. I got to tell you, I was actually like really surprised when I asked you like, hey, do you want to do the podcast? And you were like, yes, because I just feel like, you know, you just wrote a whole book. You like, let me go sit down and be quiet somewhere. So thank you for making time.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. Yeah.
So Black Liturgies, it's out in the streets.
It is.
And first and foremost, how does it feel?
It feels mostly good, overwhelming, but in a good way. I feel like it's been received well by the right people, found who I was writing to. So, yeah.
It's been received well by the right people. Mm-hmm. Isn't it interesting to like have to kind of curate the language that way at this point? Because when you're writing this type of material, you want it to get to the folks who need it,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes. And you have to calibrate your own evaluations for success because you, at least for me, it's easy to start to think too broadly. And I really need to narrow in on, okay, who do I actually trust, you know, to evaluate my work and determine if it's successful in the world. And yeah.
How has that process changed since your first release, This Here Flesh?
Yes. My first book, This Here Flesh, I feel the title was vague enough that it found itself in all kinds of hands. And I mean, there's a pretty large white readership for it, which I'm not complaining. It's money in my pocket at the end of the day. But I think with this book, it's different. Black is in the title and, you know, kind of unapologetically placed there. And it's, I try to be really clear from the beginning. I'm not interested in, you know, standing at a gate to say who can enter the words and who can't. I don't have the energy for that, but I'm writing out of a Black interior life specifically.
What made you want to take on that approach with this next project?
I think it was it was a long time coming. So I'd started Black Liturgies, the social media kind of like digital project in the summer of 2020. And a few weeks into that, I was getting DMs saying, can you compile these into a book? We need this to be a kind of physical thing. And I took my time in doing that. I ended up writing This Here Flesh first to kind of introduce people to me. This Here Flesh is more about me, my family's stories, my grandma, my father, and myself. But Black Liturgies, I feel like that community specifically has been waiting for to have a kind of physical artifact that isn't owned by these social media algorithms and platforms that you can pick up and put down whenever you need to. And I mean, I've been in spiritual spaces really since college. I guess also growing up, my family's not religious, but in college was the first time I was in kind of organized religious spiritual spaces for the first time consistently. And I know what it is to belong to white dominated spiritual spaces and white dominated liturgies specifically. And I just needed something different. I needed something that I felt like I could trust, something that wasn't so linear, something that wasn't written by a man in the 16th century who actually hated me and my blackness and my queerness.
Right. Like hated and fetishized at the same time.
Absolutely. And it's very difficult to kind of enter those words as if they are to some kind of divine being or as if they are to God in a way that I can trust.
I mean, what is liturgy?
So the most basic kind of translation of the Greek, it means work of the people or work for the people. I think of it as any kind of structure or form of connecting with the divine or connecting with the sacred, whatever that is for you. So people typically think of like Catholic liturgy, like a mass or an Anglican Eucharist service where you're kind of reciting these words, which is valid, but I think it transcends that. It's a kind of collective shaping of, okay, we're coming to the sacred together intentionally. This is kind of a structure for how that could look like. Were you raised in any kind of spiritual background or familiar with the word?
I mean, when you said Anglican, my mom went to Anglican high school in Grenada. Mm-hmm. My grandmother was like super duper religious and was Anglican. And then when we came, you know, growing up, my mom would have us go to like an Episcopalian church. Mm-hmm. I didn't formally grow up in like the church, but I had a lot of people that had various religious practice. So like I would be at a Baptist church with my friend Shayla. I'd be at Episcopalian church with my mom. I'd be at a Seventh-day Adventist church with my godmother, you know? Mm-hmm. So I got like a pretty... I'd be at a Catholic church with Alyssa, you know, so I got like a pretty, or I'd be at a white Baptist church with Bonnie. So it was like an array of spaces that I wanted nothing to do with, but that all were filled with people that really were committed to them.
Mm-hmm. I resonate with that. So like growing up, you go here and there with different friends and different people. There was a strange period of time where we went to a white Baptist church with my great aunt Kathy after her husband died. And we didn't know, I mean, my family, we didn't pray. There wasn't a Bible in our house, but we went with her because she was alone.
Got it.
We ended up in these spaces. But I've been in these different spiritual locations. Some of them I felt free in, some of them I didn't. You mentioned the Episcopal Church, and that is where I first encountered liturgy. And as a writer, was like, this is beautiful. But then when you do some digging into the man who wrote it, Thomas Cranmer in the 16th century, I know what was happening to my ancestors while he was writing this book. It complicates your relationship with, you know, sitting in a church pew. So now I think I tried to, you know, be transparent. I've been formed in Christian traditions since college, but I think of my spirituality as kind of it can't be defined by that. I think it transcends that. I'm interested in liturgy is kind of altar making. Liturgy is connecting with the ancestors. I think it doesn't need to look so
rigid.
Clear, so precise. Yeah, rigid. Exactly.
I think that, so what you've written here, right, is an oeuvre of work that combines your your liturgy, right, with the words of others that support the different pathways that you're talking about in here. Because, you know, when we see the project on the internet, it's like sometimes you're thematic and sometimes you'll just post like, y'all need to hear this quote today, right? So the way that you've laid it out in the book, you have specific spaces that the language is adherent to, right? Whether it's artistry, Mother's Day, repair, etc. I love that because it makes it referenceable, right? Like you wake up, you're like, I need something for reunion. Well, Cole, all right, 274, Cole, what you got for reunion? I'm 274 because I got to go to my high school reunion and I don't know. Or it's, I'm about to see my ex. I don't know. Okay, reunion. Ancestors. May we never forget the beauty of what we saw and did and the untranslatable experience of being loved deeply and blackly,
Robin Cass Lewis. But then you couple these quotes with your own language. And what I think is so uniquely Black is that you employ things like, okay, this is going to be a call and response. Mm-hmm. You know, like even if you're by yourself or like for a collective, like it's a practical piece of work for using liturgy to mold community. Well, not mold, but to bring community. Am I accurate in that assessment?
Yes, definitely. And I think there's something, for me, I feel like there's something really refreshing, something healing in call and response, or it can be when you are positioned either as follower or as the leader of, you know, and to practice a little bit more imagination for what those roles can look like. There are times where maybe you're leading the liturgy and other people need to listen to you and center your voice, your cadence, the rhythm of your speech. And then there are times where you have to submit to being a part of a collective and being a part of the witness and staying in the words that aren't always centered around you or grounded, or, you know, the pulse isn't always kept by you. And I think there's a lot there for us, that just the structure of call and response in Black tradition of power and how power can function actually in really beautiful ways.
So like, how do you want people to use this book or to live through this book?
It's a good question. I have images that I imagine more than concrete ways. Like I imagine while I was writing, I kept imagining this group of women sitting around on couches, like talking, picking it up, setting it down, like maybe reading something, maybe not. But I also like the idea of some of it being encountered alone. I think some words are only safe in certain company. And so I think of some of the liturgies in the book, I think, well, yes, I think there's a collective energy to liturgy, but I'm under no illusion that every single prayer in this book is going to be safely held by every community. So I like the idea of people encountering it alone for the sections that they need to, but also kind of bridging it into smaller groups where it feels safe or right.
I mean, is it safe to call this a spiritual text?
Sure.
She's like, I'm down.
You know, but people get, they get really...
That's why I said safe.
Yeah, right. They get really defensive of that term.
That's
or like
why
term
I said
sacred
that.
Text. But for me...
I didn't say sacred.
Right. That's true.
But you know?
But I think it is a spiritual text, even if it lacks complete definition as to what spirituality.
Okay, fair. I mean, sacred at this point, it's like, was it written on parchment? You know, like, I mean, like, it's like, it requires like millions and hundreds of years for something to be called sacred these days. Whereas, like, I feel like down the line, you know, like, The Bluest Eye is a sacred text. Like, I consider The Bluest Eye to be sacred text, right? Like, I consider Still I Rise to be sacred text. And I don't need 500 years from now to happen in order to identify that at present. But I asked, do you consider it a spiritual text? Because where would you say the Black voice can be enhanced with more attention to creating like spiritual texts? And I asked that just in the context of a lot of folks, myself included, really identifying at present that the real path forward in Black unity is that, right? Is unity, community, and education. And like, what are the pathways that people take to that? And spirituality has been one of them. But I'm just curious in your opinion, like, where do you feel like a spiritual text fits in the context of the Black community at present in terms of its necessity or lack thereof?
I mean, when I think about spirituality, I'm thinking about the interior life that so many people before me have spoke to. And when I say I wrote this out of the Black interior life, I mean, not just out of my own inner world, but I tried my best to do what Toni Morrison calls, you know, this practice of imagination for her ancestors, the people that came before her. And I think I spent a lot of years talking and thinking about Black liberation without meaningfully contending with what was happening in me and how systems of oppression and anti-Blackness and indignity were living and surviving in me. And when we, I think, when we confront our interior lives and when we protect, I think, protect, confront, preserve the Black interior life, we're able to kind of withstand the violence of the world around us better. I think we're clear about who we are. We're clear about what we want. We're clear about our memory.
Yeah.
And that can only do good for me. You know, people, I think, make the assumption that I'm a very religious person or, you know, a person of a lot of faith. I personally don't have a great amount of faith. I wake up most days not believing that God exists at all. At the end of the day, I have to figure out why I wrote a book to a God I'm not convinced exists. Mm. But I think there's meaning in the attempt. I think there's meaning in the journey of trying to connect your interior life with something beyond, something sacred or some mystery.
Was there any like catalyst or like moment that you can look to that you feel like started to shift your ability to look at your interior life?
Reading. This is maybe an obvious, maybe it's too obvious of an answer, but I do feel like reading did it for me. So you said Bluest Eye is a sacred text for you. Beloved is my sacred text. The books I kind of sleep next to that are on my nightstand, you know, Morrison, June Jordan, Audre Lorde. I encountered all of them and felt like they, well, I'll just say this about the Black novel in general. It's very difficult to find a kind of a Black novel that's not speaking to the Black interior life.
Facts.
Toni Morrison, what I quoted earlier about that practice of imagination, she has this essay in The Sight of Memory, and she's talking about a very specific time where Black people were beginning to show up in books for the first time, Black enslaved people. And she's criticizing the moment and saying, okay, well, you're finally putting us in books, but it's completely absent of the Black interior life. You're putting our physicality in books, but you're not putting complicated interior lives into your writing. And so when she talks about that practice of imagination, it's in part in resistance to all kinds of writing that had begun that was emptying us and reducing us to one-dimensional caricatures. And so when I encounter, you know, Beloved, when I encounter Octavia Butler and kind of Lauren and Parable of the Sower, you know, my God is a different name. And she has this rich interior life that is very complicated. I feel compelled to journey.
Can I just say real quick that y'all be acting like Parable of the Sower is an easy read and it is not. So I just want
really
to point it out for everybody out there that Parable of the Sower and Song of Solomon, and let me also add W.E.B. Du Bois' Souls of Black Folks are three of the hardest reads out here, okay? And y'all be really just throwing these names out here like, yeah, y'all didn't read that. And I am a smart person called Arthur Riley. And each of those books has made me have to put it down and say, are you a smart person?
That's how I felt. The first page of Beloved, that's how I felt. I was like, I don't know if I can make this journey. I don't know if this is meant for me.
I can make this journey. Like, I have tried four times to read Song of Solomon. Four.
Mm.
And each time she pushes me back and says, you're not ready. You're not ready. It's like, it's one of my bucket list books. Like, I hope that at some point I have enough time that it's like, it's literally like a book associated with vacation. One day I will have three straight months to be able to read this. Cause I can't, it's not a pick up, put down. It's like, you have to be committed to the text. And like, if it wasn't assigned to me in a classroom, like I need to figure out another time. In my Patreon, folks are always asking me to do a book club. And Cole, I'm like, we can't because I don't read fast enough and y'all gonna get annoyed with me. You're gonna be like, why are we still in the same book? We've been here for 6 months. That was my side note, y'all. That was just my side note.
No, that is real. That is real. And I think it's real because they're disorienting. I mean, Souls of Black Folk, I can't. That's more than disorienting. But I feel like, you know, Song of Solomon, Beloved, Parable of the Sower, I feel like it's almost intentional in a subversive way of trying to make it disorienting to kind of enter that world so that other people can experience the disorientation of the worlds that we're forced to occupy. But it is hard. I'm like, I don't know who's speaking. I don't know what's happening, but you will. I believe you will meet that goal because
I believe in you.
And there's plenty I haven't read, but I think even just reading fiction in general does something to how you think about your own interior life and how seriously you take it. Because all of us, you know, we have worlds inside of us. It's just a matter of who's paying attention and who's not. And I think what fiction does is when it forces you into someone else's interior life, you can't help but to confront yours. Morrison says when she practices imagination for the interior life of her ancestors, they are her entrance. She says, they are my entrance into my own inner world, which is, I think, a beautiful paradox.
I think there's something like consistent with literature doing that, right? No matter where you're from or, you know, like we always talk about like butterfly in the sky. I can go twice as high because I took a look in a book, right? Mm-hmm. But how would you say, because I'm always fascinated by the uniqueness of pop culture and art for Black people in America and how it has had to speak for us. Can you just expound upon like the uniqueness of what you're talking about as it relates to Black folks? Because what you're basically saying is that it's almost as if like the fiction gives us entry into our own nonfiction. And so like, I'm just curious if you feel like there's a uniqueness in the necessity for that for Black folks versus the way fiction has does that for others.
I think it's a journey everyone has to make. I think white people, for example, have the same call to examine their interior lives, but for a different reason, because they can't stop launching bombs and lynching people. And they need to figure out what's going on in their inner lives that is perpetuating that.
Richard Wright has a quote that I just learned. I'm paraphrasing, but essentially the quote is, wherever white people go, they create a nigger.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And they have to figure out why that is. Why is that necessary?
Why do y'all need a nigger? Right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like it's just as urgent of a call for other people, but Black people specifically, I would say the reason is a little bit more distinct. I'll just say what the first thing that comes to my mind is if you descend from people who were enslaved, you descend from people who at some point in history, their liberation, their freedom was relegated to their interior life. They didn't have agency in their bodies. My great-great-great-grandmother didn't have agency of what over what she ate, what she did. She didn't always have full agency over what she said, but what she did have agency over are those secret places, I believe, in her inner world that no master can touch. I like to think they were cussing out people in their minds. Also, preserving stories, preserving memory in their interior lives that they weren't always able to articulate in the world around them. And so the journey for us to stay close to the Black interior is really it's an intergenerational calling. It's an intergenerational way of being in the world that we have to, that there are parts of us that were not liberated. We're not liberated to always bring into the external world. And so I feel like in cultivating and paying attention to what's happening in me, it's one way to honor, it's one way to bear witness to what I can't say when a cop pulls me over, you know, what I can't do when someone does so and so to me, but also what was in my grandma, what was in her grandmother. Yeah. Do you think of yourself as, or are you, I feel like people who are very liberation-minded or justice-minded are either two ways, like in my friend group, and I think of you as someone like that. They either just do not have time for like, they cannot stand, they're like, Cole, shut up, what I'm talking about, but our inner lives, or they are very, very invested in their inner lives, even if that looks like shame or guilt, but they're very there. They're very aware of what's happening, very introspective people. Where do you fall on the spectrum?
I'm the latter.
Mm.
I'm the latter because I wholeheartedly believe that our ability to be there for our community rests upon our ability to understand the inner self.
Mm.
Like that is something I feel like is a key element for sustaining, for revitalizing, because in being there with community, right? Like there are these outside elements that affect you. And so if you don't have that inner knowledge of you, it is a mystery that you're taking time away from your community to constantly try to solve. Mm-hmm. Like you know what I mean? Like you're constantly disrupted by these disruptions and you have to check in periodically. I mean, I feel like there's times that are far more introspective than others, right? Like there's, like right now, like I'm in a midlife crisis. So now it's just very like, it's all seals on deck. You know what I mean? Like, we just, like, we got to get in there. We got to understand, you know? Because I feel like you have these overflows of epiphany, right? And I know for me, sometimes it's actually my outside work that then triggers me to be like, oh, now it's time to do some inside work because I experienced these outside things. I mean, I would say since October 7th, like right before October 7th, I had like this epiphany that I really had a lot of holes in my scholarship and that I had become a passive learner, which is something that I just abhor. And I had become just so involved in the business of like business that I didn't even realize that had happened, where I'd become a passive learner. Of course, I am a curious person, so information makes its way for me, but I wasn't like an active learner. And when I ended up watching this masterclass called Black Life, Black History, Black Love, something like that, I just learned so much in like one flight on Delta that I was like, how could you possibly understand where we are going if you missed this many steps on where we've been? As it relates to the passing of the Housing Rights Act, as it relates to the true, you know, process of Reconstruction, et cetera, right? So the introspective part, I think, is imperative. And I think this book does do both. You know, I think it has language that encourages the outside consciousness to expand and refine in some ways, but blur in some ways, right? And then in contrast, it actually asks questions of yourself that you may not have considered to ask. And it has language even in dealing with yourself that some of us maybe didn't have for our fails and our victories. When you finish writing, well, first of all, how do you know you're finished?
That's a good question. I would need to think to figure out a good answer for how I know I'm finished. Because I think if I'm being real, I mark it in the wrong ways. Based on like an outline as opposed to really feeling like I'm finished. Well, because in my ideal world, ideally, I think I would feel some, or I'd have some understanding of when I've reached the place. But I'm realizing I'm a perfectionist. This is a new revelation for me.
Did that come out of the book? Because, you know, when you write some shit, you find out things about yourself that you're like, huh, didn't know that.
You know, it came out of the digital Black Liturgies project and me being like, what is happening? Why am I so self-critical? But I think because perfectionism in me doesn't look like the trope, and in a lot of people doesn't look like kind of like the trope that we see of perfectionism in like white women, the like type A kind of thing you get in movies. And so I never identified as that. I'm like, well, that's not me. I'm chill. But actually, I have a very loud inner critic. And so nothing feels done ever. When there are times where I've probably written things that are written to completion or are written to goodness or like a good standard and have not believed them to be, unfortunately.
What does your inner critic's voice sound like?
It sounds like a raving intellectual. It sounds like people that I met in college that in a season where I was so desperate to belong, I contorted myself into all kinds of things. And I find when I'm writing, it's every once in a while, I've started to ask myself, like, who's in the room with you, Cole? Really, who's in the room with you? Because I thought I was over it. You know, I thought I'd gotten free. And even when I was writing This Here Flesh, I would find myself appealing to this non-existent kind of white professor man that has nothing to do with my book.
Right.
Or what I want to be or do in the world.
Where did you go to school?
Pitt, University of Pittsburgh.
Okay.
Yeah.
The whites.
Very white, very white.
What made you decide to go there?
I didn't really have many choices. I grew up in Pittsburgh. I grew up in the city and
black and yellow, black and yellow, black and yellow, black and yellow.
Yes. And I was the first in my family to, well, my sister went to college but didn't finish. She did a year and we couldn't afford it. I was the first to go. I didn't know what I was doing. I applied late, didn't have help. Yeah. So Pitt was kind of it by default. and close enough to be with my family and lucky enough to be given financial aid, even mm-hmm. though I had no clue what I was doing.
What did you end up majoring in?
Writing. And here I am. I wasn't writing originally. I was physics. And
that's why I said, what did you end up?
Yes. Yeah.
How we arrive is very rarely how we leave when it comes to the school thing.
Yep. And I took my good old time getting to what I really wanted to do. I told myself if one, and this is the thing with the white professor voice, I told myself if one professor tells me I could do this, if one professor tells me I can write, I'll leave the physics major and I'll switch. And yeah, it happened eventually and I did switch, but I was a junior and I wasted a lot of time getting
there. No, there's not a waste.
It's true.
It's not a waste. It's not a waste.
I do still love science, but I was waiting on someone else's voice to affirm. And I think creatives have to do that a lot. I don't know if you resonate with that.
Yeah,
it's like you feel like you can't call yourself an artist until someone else calls you an artist.
I mean, I think there's something to be said for the fact that you came in as a physics major. So you are type A. Like, that's that. And in science, there's hypotheses that have to be proved and or proven. And so, like, you had a hypothesis, like, perhaps I'm an artist, and you needed it to be proven. And the method by which you decided that was, you know, someone else that you trust. I mean, I think that's, there's different routes for every artist, right? Then you have some artists that are just like, I don't need nobody, just this heroin, you know? So,
it's true.
You know, I think there's, I know for me, I mean, as an artist, I feel like there was just no other option. Like, I just have always been a glaring weirdo. And so it wasn't even like anyone ever said it as much as it was just like, well, obviously. And I would have to just kind of be telling people like, yeah, this is what's going to be. Like, I mean, there's just no other thing I like to do. I mean, I can get these grades, but I'm really want to be over here like acting, you know, and orating.
Yeah.
But I think that for an artist, the reason why I say it's not a waste is because for an artist, every journey is valuable. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no waste of time when you're an artist when it comes to like the art, because it's all content. It's all content. If you're a writer or you're a performer of any kind, any journey ends up being a part of the work. So it's like, you can be annoyed by it. You can be like, ugh. But then even that makes its way into the work, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm curious to know, like, who was the professor that told you could write? And what did you write that made them say you could write?
It was two professors. So I waited. I waited for the second affirmation. The first affirmation was this white man. His name's Dave Newman. He probably wouldn't even remember me. I didn't speak in class in any of my classes.
What was the class?
It was poetry. And I'd written a poem, and he pulled me aside after and was like, what are we doing here? You know, why are you?
Really?
Why science?
That's big.
Yeah.
To question your entire like trajectory off of an assignment is actually like really big. That's big stuff.
Very bold. But then there was this black woman, queer. She was just
there it is.
Very cool, shaved head, like walked into class with combat boots. I was in love with her. She pulled me aside. She'd written on my paper, you know, come to office hours, which I'd never been to office hours for any teacher. Again, no professor would remember me. I was unremarkable in classes.
Clearly, that's not true. Well, carry on.
Unremarkable in person. Maybe memorable on page, but in person, I just kind of kept to myself. But
ensemble.
Yeah, I went and she said, do you think you can do this? Do you want to do an MFA? I didn't end up doing an MFA, but she had just a lot of questions about what was stopping me, and that conversation is important. I have a question for you because you got into being an artist. I want to know, like, what? So I feel like people have very narrow expectations for people who are artists. We're in a season. You mentioned October 7th. This isn't the only thing you speak out about, but obviously you've been vocal about Palestine. You've been vocal about other liberation issues. And what do you say to people who kind of don't understand why you are speaking to this as an artist? Or do you connect those things in your mind, like your calling as an artist to your calling to be about liberation? Are those connected for you?
They're intrinsic. They're intrinsic. I mean, essentially, to me, artistry is it's a God skill. You're creating something from nothing, right? Which is what people attribute to the creator, right? Just making a thing out of nothing. And so there's a responsibility in it, I believe. And there's a alchemy and a magic in it. And if you have access to that, then you have a connectivity to the us of it all. And I really do believe we're all connected. And I don't mean that in just like an ethereal, like, you know, like my brothers and sisters, we're all connected. Like, mm-hmm. we're all made of the same things. You know, we're all made of atoms. I think for some reason, some of us are evolved in other ways. Like, I've definitely come to believe there's like basically two kinds of people, people who crave power and people who protect peace. Mm-hmm. And I really feel like you can bifurcate it, because like you can even look at someone who's not, they're not trying to be like a dictator, but they're trying to like dictate your life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I mean, like I've dated people like that where it's like, as much as you say that you don't want to argue, like, nigga, you ain't doing nothing to protect this peace.
Mm-hmm.
You actually want to dominate me. Like, that's actually what you want, right? Whereas like, if you really were about protecting peace, our pathway to this issue, it would be different, right? So I say all of that to say, though, that in this particular situation, as any other situation, like, I feel that if I have a God skill and I am able to see us on this whole other plane, then I am responsible for like playing as much of a role as possible in protecting humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some people might be like, Amanda, are you protecting humanity when you clap back in the Instagram comments? It's like, yes.
Yes.
Actually. Yes. And then I've had people literally say to me, like, you clapping back taught me that I could clap back.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I never felt like I could respond to people saying funny style stuff to me. Like, I felt like I needed to be that quote unquote bigger person meant silence.
Yes.
And it's like, well, no, sometimes that's the case, but other times it can mean like, no, you have a bigger access to vocabulary to shut this shit down.
Mm-hmm.
So I consider it to be the two parts together. And as an artist, I feel like I haven't really gotten to do that through artistry in this season, which I think has really been detrimental to me emotionally. And it's forcing me to examine other pathways for expression. Cause I feel like the social media of it all also just kind of gets you locked into like the commentating and the sharing and the information. And it's like, and that's a cycle that can be very helpful for others, but it's very, very exhausting. And it's not that I'm like, oh, I have to shut down because this is too difficult. Like all of this stuff is too difficult. Like, cause that's not what I'm trying to give.
Yeah.
But I feel like this is the only metaphor I can come up with right now, but if you were just peeing and you weren't pooping, like your body would not be functioning properly.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're still voiding.
Yeah.
But there's a whole other way that you need to get shit out, yes. Literally shit out,
mm-hmm.
that like has to happen for things to be functioning properly.
Wait, I love
and
that.
And even in that metaphor, I literally developed IBS since October 7th. And I think it's because I am not properly like getting the things out through the ways that they should be.
Yes.
TMI, TMI. There you go. That was a really thorough answer to your question.
It was a good answer. I'm never going to forget that metaphor. I won't forget it. It is so true. And I feel like people have a very specific expectation of artists to be fake, kind of high road. You want them to be sages, these altruistic,
yes.
You know.
Oh my gosh.
Angry. Like people,
someone the other day was like, I really was very surprised that you laughed at Alicia Keys's note, her misstep and the piano in the Super Bowl. I'm like, y'all really don't know me. Y'all really don't know me. I'm like, why was that off for you? Like, first of all, I'm also a comedian and that shit was hilarious. So that's hilarious. That right there is hilarious. Also, the theory that like she lost her voice because she legitimately infringed upon these people's relationship. Like, come on. Also, shout out to Mashonda. That's my girl. But I can't, like, just, you know, they want me as an artist to, like, rise so high above, like, shit that's so obvious. Mm-hmm. So, I can't. I'm not that girl, Cole. But I will read you. Your book gets us there, though. Mm. Your book is very high vibrational and very, like, I am above the fray. I am above the fray.
Thank you. I don't feel like I am, but no, I think it's good that we resist that, though, because I think you end up making bad art when you are trying to be overly good, you know, because it's not really goodness you're approaching. It's like complacency. It's status quo. It's,
yes,
I have to really, I'm, you know, more quiet, a little bit more soft-spoken person. I have to push myself to be angry on the page, to allow other things to complicate my words, as opposed to just kind of calmness, tranquility. And so people are always like, oh, are people mean in your DMs? Do they like cuss you out? And you do get death threats. And honestly, not much. I think mostly people leave me alone because I'm quiet. But when I do, I feel like I've written something that matters. I'm like, it's become this weird thing. I'm like, oh, you must have said some shit that actually, that's like, actually raw in some way. That actually, yeah. So I'm trying to pull myself out of the overly, the fake good, the fraudulent good.
Well, I was going to ask, like, do you feel like that was developed as a mechanism of like protection of some sort?
Oh yeah, for sure. I think, I mean, when I speak about anger specifically, absolutely. I think I'm divorced from my anger because I didn't want to be reduced to it. You know, no one does. No, you know, and so I think,
I went
in the opposite direction and tried to be as disarming and placid, yes, as possible. Don't look at me. I'm anti-conflict.
I mean, you've said it in this interview. Like I was, you know, like I was in class. I wasn't answering questions.
Yes.
I wasn't talking. I was just like ordinary, et cetera.
Yep. I wanted invisibility. That's the only imagination I had for myself is how do I feed myself and be as invisible as possible.
That
I don't think I'm unique in that because to be seen is a risk. It's a risk.
What are you telling?
Yeah. Right. So I have to push against that. And I feel like, again, it's Black literature that takes me there. It's the unapologetic nature of anger on the page. Not even just fiction. Again, Audre Lorde, she has this essay, Uses of Anger, that I basically read once a week at this point. I'm like, anger is sacred, anger is holy. I need to tap into this. I don't want to live one-dimensional or out. Mm-hmm. I don't want to live out of people's one-dimensional expectations for me. It's hard.
Mm. Well, our people have definitely more dynamic expectations of you and they have questions. Okay. So we are going to go to our special questions section. Shout out to the SEAL squad over on Patreon and hear their thoughts.
The last dose.
You have such an expanse of quotes, right? It's just like, where do you pull from? Where do you source?
I have a very privileged bookshelf. And so
nice.
I don't have to journey far for inspiration. It's like right in my hallway, a very large bookshelf that I have well stocked. So that helps. And I don't have another job anymore. I'm just writing. So really that means I'm mostly reading. So I essentially get to just read a whole lot, which is nice. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of post-it notes everywhere. If you could see the chaos of some of the books, and I also use like the notes app and all of that. But yeah, that quote, don't fall asleep inside your enemy's dream. That's a good one for Black History Month, especially.
You know what I'm talking about? And my fellow Grenadian, Audre Lorde. Mm. I need to get into June Jordan.
Oh.
Do you have any texts off top that you feel like are like, start here?
Do you like poetry?
Yes.
I mean, she has just a collection. It's called The Essential June Jordan or The Essential Works of June Jordan. I actually have two copies if you want me to send you it. I can mail you a copy.
I will not stop you.
Yeah, so I'll mail that to you. But June Jordan is good. She's an example of someone who, she sounds so, if you listen to her read, she sounds all calm and like lofty, and she has like this beautiful, you know, soft musical voice. But then the things she's saying are so not what anyone else. She says, sometimes hatred for your enemies is the only way to end self-hatred, which no one is allowed to say. You can't say you can hate me. You're not allowed to hate anyone. She says, I must become a menace to my enemies. I must become, how much longer until I teach myself retaliation? So she has like this fire and this, you know, bite to her that I don't think people expect. I'll send you.
I'll be waiting on bated breath for the text. Cole, you're lovely. You know that already.
Thank you.
You know, when you write this kind of work that seeks to encourage people to seek, you know that there's like so much weight in your words, right? Like even when you just described that you are in a season where you're not just like casual about writing. You arrive at the page having taken a journey to get there every time. With this book, where do you think, and this is just, you know, today, this is just on this day that we're recording this, where do you feel like the weight of these words has carried you forward to?
I think it's carried me into the collective in a way that writing for so long felt like a solitary endeavor. It felt, and my life in many ways, being shy, being more private, I feel like this project specifically has reminded me that writing is never a project of solitude, even if it's the ancestors, if it's my sister calling and making sure I've eaten that day and I'm not just in front of a screen, you know, or the people who follow me on Black Liturgies, that it really is sustained in the arms of the collective. Creativity is sustained in the arms of collective. And any kind of imagination for liberation, I think, can only be practiced together. That's where it's taking me, out of isolation.
You just gave me a word, because I just signed a book deal to write my next book. And, you know, part of the, I've been stepping into it like, and now for our next solitary endeavor. And there's a certain like, about that. And the way that you just put that, I feel like will be very useful for me in alleviating just this feeling that I'm walking into a cave to write and reimagining it more as like, no, I'm walking into a field and like we're all here, not a cotton field. but you know, more like, you know, Afropunk, like more like just a wide open space where all of us are willfully here to be unencumbered in our connection. Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Thanks. You bring out, listen, I'm already a vocab chick, but like you've literally brought out some words today. I'm like, ooh, placid. You ain't said placid in a long time. Unencumbered. Okay. So thank you so much, Cole, for making time for us. You all know what to do. You need to go out and buy both books, Black Liturgies and This Here Flesh. I'm like you, I don't eat. And then my assistant has to be like, did you eat? No. But This Here Flesh and Black Liturgies are available for purchase, and please do your best to buy them from independent bookstores, particularly independent Black bookstores. And Cole, I just wish you peace, but also like excitement. Like I want both for you. Like, yeah. And I love that you are, for someone who's shy, you right here on camera, girl, you getting out here. We know who you are and we love it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.